The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
Happy Wednesday. It is the Brad Sessmatt Show. I'm Jeff Munn, radio voice of ASU Women's Basketball, stadium voice of Phoenix Rising FC, who have a match tonight. And we're here for Brad today. We'll be here tomorrow, so don't say we didn't warn you. And we're delighted to be with you on Sports360AZ.com. We partner with AZCentralSports.com. A day where we will obviously talk a little baseball about the D-backs, who have a game this afternoon with the Pirates going for a sweep. I just can't figure this team out. It's just hard to really invest in what's going on and say this is the way it's going to be the rest of the year. But we'll go some other directions, too. Scott Bordeaux, the outstanding beat writer who covers the Suns for AZ Central, will join us. And I'm going to expand a little bit on something I talked about yesterday. There have been so many players that have come in and worked out with the Suns, as normally teams will do, no matter what draft pick they've got. But there is still some debate as to whether or not DeAndre Ayton is the best fit for this team in the number one overall selection. We might get some thoughts from him, too, about what the club is looking at in terms of the 16th pick in the first round and some other items related to the NBA. Then John Wilner, San Jose Mercury News college football insider and one of the real dialed-in guys on the Pac-12, will join us. We'll assess how things are going to this point for Herm Edwards at ASU, Kevin Sumlin at Arizona. And there was a story last week, there was actually a story last week and this week that got me to thinking we ought to have John on the program. Last week, the Pac-12 passed a ruling that said they will no longer, I don't think they've ever done this, but they will not send five-win football teams to bowl games, essentially teams with losing records. A 6-6 team is one thing. UCLA played here in the Cactus Bowl last year with a 6-6 record. Counter to that, the NCAA is very close to approving an expansion of the bowl schedule to include three more bowl games in the year 2020, which I don't get. I just don't understand. I mean, obviously, the reason they would consider doing it is somebody is making some cash off of this. But in terms of do we really need three more bowl games, we'll get into it a little bit later on. I don't want to tie up too much time with it here, but we have other things to talk about. And I can hear off in the distance, if you look up to the corner of your screen, if you're watching us on the web, the eCam is about to go into action.
Hello, Money.
Eric Sorensen, the outstanding producer, vice president of everything at Sports360AZ.com. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. I'm doing really well, man. You bringing up the no five-win Pac-12 teams to bowl games.
I'm in favor of that. Nobody should go to a bowl game with five wins.
Brought up a funny joke my
yes, sir?
College roommate at TCU brought up to
yes.
me last week. He said no five-win bowl game teams from the Pac-12 is really going to damage Texas's chances to make it into the Pac-12 after all. I chuckled because anytime anyone in the state of Texas that isn't associated with the University of Texas can take a shot at Bevo, we do.
So. You know what? I was in Austin in March.
Great city.
ASU is in. Oh,
great,
phenomenal
great city.
Great
place. Great school too.
And I love the campus. I did not get over to the football stadium, but from a distance, that stadium looks old to me.
They have multiple Starbucks inside their stadium, and they've had multiple Starbucks inside their stadium.
I'm there, dude.
Since I think the first time I was there was like 2002, and at the time I thought that was really cool and revolutionary, and now it's just they have a bunch of Starbucks inside a football stadium.
On the other hand, their baseball stadium, which has also been around for a while.
Super nice.
I love that facility. The basketball arena is showing a little age, but it's still a pretty nice venue, and
they print money at that school, so they don't really have anything to worry about. I'm sure they're going to upgrade all those facilities.
Everything around Austin, it strikes me as odd. Now, I know Round Rock is kind of close by and it's a suburb, and they have a AAA baseball team there. But it strikes me as odd that there's not much in a sporting sense in Austin beyond UT.
Nope.
And it's a very large city.
They have a G League team now, I believe.
That's right. They do. They do. But no AAA baseball, no AA baseball. Uh-uh. And it's, it just strikes me as odd, but it's true. When you listen to the radio in Austin, and we were there, I think we got there on a Thursday, we were there through Monday. Over the weekends in Austin, every sports radio station is, we're talking UT spring football, we're talking UT tennis recruiting.
Much like Omaha, Nebraska.
Pretty much.
Slash Lincoln, Nebraska.
Well, yeah, I was going to say Lincoln in regard to the Big Red.
Yep.
And Texas, by the way, is in the College World Series.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, they're going to be there. Texas Tech is there.
Oh, two of my favorites.
I know. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to rub it
in. That's okay.
But
I'm actually headed out to Omaha. I'm going out to the...
Are you really?
Yep, I go every year to the College World Series because usually my alma mater is there. This year, not so much, but...
Yeah, and they weren't expected to have that great a year. I mean,
they were picked third in the nation to start.
Were they
the
really?
They were.
I remember that they were struggling
GCU.
Middle of the season and kind of faded, and
they got hot late, lost in the Big 12 championship game, did not make the postseason. But anyway, I digress.
Onto
things much more important on this program than
including talking about the major news events of the day, brought to you by Sagic Cornell. Thank you for the transition, Eric. Sagic Cornell is the place you ought to go if you have not delved into the subject yet of protecting your family in case of whatever. We are reminded on a daily basis that it's the things that you can't plan for. You think you've got everything taken care of, and then life throws you a surprise. And that's why Sagic Cornell should be a part of your planning for your family. If you'll go to Sagic Cornell, you'll find out how easy it is to set your family up with the kind of security that is very important to them. Because you can say to yourself, I've got it all worked out, I've got it all mapped out, but none of us really know, do we? The curveball could be coming at any time. So Sagic Cornell is a terrific partner to work with you on making certain your family has the peace of mind they need, especially for the young ones as they grow up and that they know that everything will be taken care of no matter what. And we appreciate Sagic Cornell's partnership with us on this program and on Sports360AZ.com. D-backs beat the Pirates last night. Kind of a funny game because the D-backs got out to a 6-0 lead, and then the Pirates got a 6-run fourth. Now, I'm looking at Clay Buchholz's line from last night, or I'm trying to find it here, and a 4-run sixth inning, and he ended up going 4 innings, 6 runs, 5 earned on 7 hits. Buchholz has been an interesting story. His ERA ballooned, if that's the term you want to use, to 3.21. So I'd still say that overall, Buchholz has been quite the find for Mike Hazen and his front office. My question all along about Buchholz is, could he sustain this long term? Now, it's not damaging. If the answer to that was no, there are reinforcements coming for the D-backs. Robbie Ray should be coming off the DL pretty soon. Shelby Miller, he's coming back from Tommy John surgery. I just don't know what you can officially expect from him. So, in any event, the D-backs got, obviously, the offense they needed. John Jay, 3-run homer in the 7th, put the game away. They go for a sweep of the Pirates this afternoon at 12:40 out at Chase Field. And, again, I'll just say this. It's a very hard thing to figure out which direction this team, who they really are. We thought that they were world beaters in April. We thought that they were going to just fall out of sight in May. Now they're starting to gain momentum again. Their lead over the Dodgers remains 3 games. The Giants are now 4.5 back. The Rockies, 5 out. I don't get it. I worry about a good friend of mine, Bud Black, and what people are going to start putting on his shoulders up in Denver if that thing doesn't get turned around. Quickly, nothing new to report on the David Johnson situation with the Cardinals. Did get a sense, kind of listening around on different talk shows yesterday, that some fans are not real crazy about the fact that a guy who didn't play much last year is trying to extract a long-term contract out of the Cardinals, and that's always the risk you run when you do holdouts, and that's exactly what this is. You start to turn, the fans start to turn against you, and I still believe this will not be an acrimonious situation. Steve Wilk was right to the point yesterday in talking to reporters, said, I don't talk about players who are not at camp. Johnson will be penalized in terms of fines for not going to the mandatory mini camp. So There are a lot of different little wrinkles to this story. And as I said yesterday, I don't anticipate that this will be solved quickly, but I also don't think it will drag on into training camp. Certainly hope not. Tie up some loose ends, Patrice Carrion, if you were not aware, did leave yesterday as head coach of Phoenix Rising FC. He'll be moving on to a Premier League team in Egypt. Rick Shantz will finish out the season. They play Las Vegas Lights FC tonight at home, 7:30, Phoenix Rising Soccer Complex. They haven't been home in a while. It's Dollar Beer Night. That ought to be a little bit of incentive to get you there, too. So lots going on, including with the Suns as they continue workouts, looking at who they're going to draft number one. Scott Bordeaux has been there every day. We'll get his thoughts on what's going on in the brain trust with the Suns and a few other items related to the NBA when the Brad Sesmat Show continues after a break on Sports360AZ.com and AZCentralSports.com. Basketball is the topic as we continue on the Brad Sesmat Show on a Wednesday. Jeff Munn for Brad. Let me mention very quickly, I forgot to mention this in the last segment, about 40 minutes from now, our Talk to the Lobe segment, which we do on Wednesday, will also have a basketball theme. Lewis Wilson, the newest member of Dan Marley's coaching staff, coming over from Utah State, will join us to talk hoops and look ahead to this coming season at Grand Canyon University. But the future's here and now for the Suns, obviously, with the number one overall pick in next week's NBA draft. And AZ Central Suns insider Scott Bordeaux joins us. And it is not, I guess, there is still some debate. I talked to a friend of mine who follows things very closely, and he was touting Marvin Bagley to me. So I guess while a lot of us are really focused in on DeAndre Ayton, I guess it's like 98% certain. Is that still 2% or 5% window of somebody else being that pick next Thursday, right?
I guess, but Jeff, I would be shocked at this point if it's anybody but DeAndre Ayton. I mean, there were so many signs after his workout that he's the guy, from Ayton saying he's not going to work out for any other team. He said he wasn't told by the Suns that he's the pick, but when he says he's not working for anybody else, I mean, could the Suns have told his agent, don't worry about working on anybody else? Could they have just shook his hand and said, you don't have to work out anywhere else? I mean, I don't know. But for him to say, I'm not working on anywhere else, I know I'm the number one pick, pretty definitive. And then just to hear Ryan McDonough's comments calling Ayton's workout phenomenal and how they see him as an anchor, or long-term anchor, both offensively and defensively. And he also said that he can count on one hand the number of guys he's seen in the draft over the last 16 years that have that kind of size, skill, and potential. So given all that, it would be a shock to not just me, but probably everybody around the NBA if he's not the pick.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point, too, because – and I want to go kind of bigger picture here in a minute, but you talked about the skill set, and even though he's a what we would call a five, a center, obviously it's 7 feet, he brings to the table a lot of the skills that are really important in the way the NBA game is played right now.
Yeah, he's not what people remember about centers 20 years ago. He's not a traditional back-to-the-basket center. He's a guy that can pop out and make an 18-foot jump shot. Can he hit the three? Yes, but, he's not going to shoot a lot of threes. I don't need my center shooting a lot of threes. You just need him to be able to, pick and pop from on a pick and roll situation, hit an 18-foot jumper to space the floor, and he can do that. He's also just a tremendous athlete. He's a guy that I think, although he's not really polished defensively, he has the athleticism to be able to cover on the perimeter and then get back. He has the athleticism to pick up guards on switches and at least try to stay in front of them. He's not a stiff 7-foot guy. He's a 7-foot-1, 260-pound guy who has a 40-inch vertical leap and is tremendously athletic. He's more like today's modern-day centers, kind of like Joel Embiid and Karl Anthony Towns, guys that are just really good athletes that can do a lot of things.
Scott Bordeaux, AZ Central Sports Suns insider with us on the Brad Sesmat Show. I'm Jeff Munn in for Brad. This goes to something, and this is the big picture thing I was talking about. I'm watching Game 7 of the Eastern Finals, and both the Celtics and Cavs are just clanging three-pointers all over the place. Boston refused to get off the idea of shooting threes. Cleveland ended up getting back in that game and winning that game. And I realize it's one game. But they made their run based on penetrating to the hoop. And my point is this. I think a game, I can't imagine the NBA as a league is thrilled with a game where a team just continues to shoot from outside even though they can't hit a thing. And I wonder to myself, is the NBA, are we about on the precipice of a trend to go back to a more traditional, the ball goes into the low post, either it stays there or it comes back out type of attack?
I don't think so. I think the NBA is going further away from that. I think it's going to positionless basketball where you have a lot of guys that can space the floor and open up the driving lane. So, no, I don't think you're going to see a lot of inside and out offense. But I will say this. There are now people on the NBA who wonder, you know, the way to attack these positionless lineups and to work them to your advantage is to get a big man who these teams have to match up to. I mean, you're not going to out Golden State. I mean, not with four potential Hall of Famers in that lineup. So if they're going to play small ball and use Draymond Green, for example, at center, maybe you try to punish them by drafting DeAndre Ayton, sticking him in the low post, and making them cover the 7'1" center who can move and do a lot of things offensively. So there are some people, including Ryan McDonough, who wonder if this trend is going to change a little bit in the sense that, all right, we cannot beat Golden State the way if we try to emulate them. We cannot beat Houston if we try to emulate them because of their talent level. So maybe we try, we're still going to space the floor and shoot threes, but maybe we get a big guy in the middle who we can force them to defend, and maybe that's to our advantage.
Well, and you bring up a good point because with the way the game is played right now, where there is such a heavy emphasis on the three-point shot, I'm curious to see, we'll assume for the moment, the obvious, that DeAndre Ayton is a son. I will be curious to see how Igor Kokoshkov utilizes him defensively because you can't just utilize him solely in the low post. The old adage goes long shots equals long rebounds. So if Ayton's going to be effective for you in the defensive end, there are going to be times you've got to get him away from the low block, I would think.
Well, you mean offensively or defensively?
Defensively.
Yeah, I think he will. I mean, he's really good with his feet in terms of movement. I mean, again, he doesn't understand a lot of defensive principles. He's 19 years old. How many 19-year-old kids coming out of college play really good defense and understand team defense? They just don't. But he's athletic enough to be able to cover a guy in the low post, but also in pick-and-roll situations to pick up a guard 20 feet from the basket and at least make it difficult for that guard to get by him to score. He's athletic enough to switch onto a power forward. So he's kind of the ideal modern-day big man is that in today's pace and space game, he can get out on the floor and defend. He's not some just lumbering big guy who, when he's 20 feet away from the basket, is completely lost defensively. That's not DeAndre Ayton.
Yeah, and you're right, too, about the matchups because and it's been a while since I've been around the NBA on a regular basis, but I think coaches are still concerned in the NBA about getting the right matchups. And if you think about the fives in this league right now, and again, it's a positionless game, but if you right at the moment, but if you try to match up your big man with Ayton, there aren't too many big guys in the NBA right now that you look at and say, okay, that's a good matchup to go against DeAndre Ayton.
Right. I mean, you're talking Anthony Davis, Joel Embiid, Karl Anthony Towns. There's not that many dominant big men in the NBA, and that's why people have said, well, you don't need a big man anymore. But I don't think that's true. I asked Steve Kerr this question when the Suns were in Oakland to play the Warriors earlier this season. I asked him about the value of centers in today's positionless NBA, and he said, he understood the question because the NBA is going away from the big man, he said if you can find big men who can play in today's game, they're even more valuable than they were because they're so rare. And that's why I think you draft DeAndre Ayton, because he's a rare athlete and has rare potential. And not many teams are going to have that kind of guy in the middle. So, and that's something you'll have over, say, 25 teams in the league. And I think that gives you an inherent advantage if he's as good as you think he is.
Scott Bordeaux, AZ Central Sports Suns Insider. So much talk about the number one pick. But I always think back to the 88 draft. That was after the big trade. Tim Perry was the first of the picks in the first round for the Suns, but the second guy they got was a guy named Marley. And I'm leading to this. At 16, I think that pick is just as crucial and could be just as difference-making to go along with Ayton. So the question becomes, where are they centered, pardon the pun, on their other first-round pick at 16?
Well, they obviously know they need a point guard. The question is, can they get a point? Well, one of the point guards they like dropped to 16. At this point, looking at all the mock drafts, I would doubt it. I don't think Colin Sexton or Trae Young or Shea Gilgeous-Alexander are dropping number 16. So, to me, the Suns have three options. They can either use the number 16 and other assets they have, number 31, a player, whatever, to move up in the first round and grab a point guard. They can use that 16 pick and other assets to trade for a veteran point guard. Or they could, if they're, say, they really like Aaron Holiday, UCLA, but they don't want to take him at 16. They think it's too high. Maybe they move down three or four spots, pick up a veteran player in a trade, and then draft Holiday. So I think they'll target a point guard with that pick, but I don't think it'll be traditional. We're just going to stay at 16 and draft a point guard. I think there's many ways they can try to go out and get a young point guard.
There would be the possibility that they draft somebody for another team and then turn around and make the trade immediately after the selection is made, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things they can do. Look, if they draft Ayton, then the one thing they need is that they need to fill their hole at point guard. You know, they do have wings already with Booker and Jackson and Warren. They still have the two young power forwards of Bender and Chris, although I think they'll try to improve that position in the offseason. But the glaring hole going forward is point guard. Alfred Payton is probably not going to be back. You know, Brandon Knight will, but he's not your long-term solution at point guard. So if you're going to build a team that you want to keep together for 4 or 5 years and become this next great Suns team, that's a position you have to fill, and they now have the assets to try to go about and do that.
Should be an interesting final week leading up to Thursday, and it'll be really interesting after that. Scott, I appreciate the time. Get some rest when you can, and we'll catch up with you down the road.
Always good to talk to you, Jeff.
Same here, sir. Scott Bordeaux, AZ Central Suns Insider. Keep up with him at AZ Central Sports. He's going to be one busy man, already is, but it's not going to slow down much anytime soon. Do we really need three more college bowl games? And are other big time conferences, should they follow the Pac-12's lead and say, if you got five wins, you're not playing in a bowl game? We'll discuss it with our friend John Wilner from the San Jose Mercury News next on the Brad Sesmatch Show. I love talking Pac-12. I love talking college football, and I'll do it anytime. And you know what? And I'm, by the way, Jeff Munn for Brad Sesmatch here on the Brad Sesmatch Show. Another guy who'll be willing to talk Pac-12 and college sports anytime because he's really good at it is John Wilner, San Jose Mercury News college football insider, and really one of the top guys in terms of being dialed into everything going on in the Pac-12. And I wanted to have him on to cover a myriad of topics. First of all, John, thanks for being with us. And you're up. You're operating from home base today, I would assume.
Yes, I am. A lot going on, though.
Well, let me start first with the note I saw last week that the Pac-12, and I believe they're the only big boy conference that has done this, and it's ironic because I don't think they've had a team go to a bowl game with five wins, unless I missed something, but they voted last week to say we're not sending five-win teams to bowl games. And my first thought was, terrific, I don't want to see a five-win team in a bowl game either, and now I hear the NCAA's talking about adding three more bowl games. It's like, what? It's just out of control.
It is, yep. Three, that would bring it to, I think it would be at 46.
Right.
Teams, I'm sorry, 86 teams out of 130. That's starting in 2020.
Right.
Yeah, so the conference, the thing is, the Pac-12 is the only conference that would do that. It's the only conference that would legislate that a 5-7 team can't go to a bowl game. In the other conferences, they just wouldn't make a rule. If the 5-7 team didn't want to go because the coaches wanted to focus on recruiting or because it was too costly and would be a money loser, then the teams wouldn't go. Nobody else has got a conference-wide rule, and I can't imagine anybody else ever doing that. You know, it does look bad, 5-7 teams. I don't like to see 5-7 teams in bowl games. Most people don't. But is it up to the conference and the schools to collectively decide that there's going to be a policy? You know, that's where I think the Pac-12 differs from other conferences.
All right, and I want to get into some other conference-related things in a minute, but I don't want to pass up the chance to kind of get up to speed on where we are with football season right around the corner. There's an interesting article today on AZ Central about, and basically the question is posed rhetorically, has Herm Edwards change the narrative related to his appointment as head football coach at ASU. He has had some recruiting, some signees in the last couple of weeks, both of whom, the most notable, were quarterbacks. From a bigger picture perspective, when you talk to your colleagues around the conference and nationally, is Herm Edwards starting to kind of change the perception of his hire at Arizona State?
There may be some of that. I mean, there's a lot of continuing skepticism, let's just say, about whether he's going to be able to do what they haven't done over the decades, which is consistently compete for titles. And it's a much more difficult landscape, I'd argue, you know, than it was when Todd Graham, you know, finished second in the division last fall. I mean, Chip Kelly, that adds an entire dynamic to the South, having Chip Kelly at UCLA, and I think Kevin Sumlin will upgrade Arizona's personnel too. In terms of the narrative, I think that part of the issue with the narrative is Arizona State itself. Okay, so they go outside the box and they hire someone who hasn't coached in 10 years and is a former business partner of the AD, and they don't have exactly the most open process, search process. But then they send out that press release with all the fancy jargon that makes you think it's MIT. And I think that kind of catapulted the whole situation into a little bit of a different realm, and it made it easy to mock what ASU was trying to do because of the way they presented it themselves, when in reality, what they're really doing is putting more resources into football. And in a lot of respects, they're catching up to some of their peer schools in terms of the org chart and the resources. I mean, that's what they're really doing. But they kind of fancied it up there with the way they presented it. I think now that presentation is, what, 6 months back behind us, and it's more about Herm Edwards coaching and running the program, you're seeing the narrative kind of move a little bit back closer towards the center, albeit with some skepticism, you know, if that makes sense.
You mentioned Sumlin. And I'm going to take this from the perspective, I'm not an insider, so to speak. I'm going to look at this, I guess, a little bit more like a fan. There is a similarity, and we're talking with John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News. There is a similarity, and let me explain it in full, to when Rich Rodriguez was hired, in the sense that here is a coach who obviously had some really noteworthy accomplishments at his former school, and in Rich Rod's case, it was at West Virginia, who really wants an opportunity to reestablish himself or to prove to his critics that he's still a very effective football coach. And lest we forget, Rich Rod was pretty effective his first couple of years in Tucson, got him into a BCS bowl game. I look at the Sumlin thing as having that kind of potential, that he's going to come in with a chip on his shoulder. I'm going to show you guys I still know what I'm doing. And Arizona will have kind of, in a way, it's not really that much of a roll of the dice. They're just catching lightning in a bottle a second time.
I think that there's certainly some parallels between, you know, the career arcs for Rodriguez and Sumlin when they got hired by Arizona. I don't necessarily think they're the same coach, type of coach, or type of personality. I think that Kevin Sumlin is probably, you know, a little bit less hard-edged, let's just say, than Rich Rod. And I also think that Sumlin is going to prove to be a better recruiter. I mean, the best player to come out of Phoenix in the last 5 years, he got when he was at Texas A&M, Christian Kirk. So, and his ability to recruit quarterbacks, I think, has been proven. I feel like, and I think that, you know, they finally got it figured out on defense with Marcel Yates, and keeping Yates was a very smart move. I think that someone's got a chance to, you know, have early success, but, you know, maybe sustain it a little bit better than Rich Rod did, because I think he's going to have better personnel. But, you know, Arizona, let's face it, Arizona is a difficult place to win consistently, and like ASU, is. Both of those schools have kind of been, you know, cyclical. Arizona's had, you know, what, four? I think they've had four seasons this century where they've been over 500 in the conference. You know, they've got work to do on facilities. They have a small recruiting base. It's a basketball school. It's a tough job, tougher job than ASU. And I think that someone will get them close to maximizing their potential closer than Rich Rod did.
Okay, let me get into a couple of things, because the persistent issue within the Pac-12 centers on the Pac-12 Network and DirecTV. I mean, we could go for an hour on why the two haven't hooked up, but let's just boil it down to this. Can this get solved?
Well, yeah, it's going to get solved, I would say, this summer when AT&T walks away. You know, AT&T has got a comprehensive deal with the Pac-12. It is distribution on UVerse. It's equipment. It's sponsorship. It's cellular rights for the athletic departments. It's a kind of a, they signed a sweeping deal, you know, 5 years ago, whatever it was. That deal expires this summer, and I believe AT&T is going to just kind of walk away from the Pac-12, and they're going to take UVerse and the sponsorship agreement and DirecTV, and they're going to go their own way. And so it's going to get solved because it is going to end.
So there is a possibility we could see the Pac-12 network ending up on DirecTV, is what you're saying?
No, I think it's going to – well, I guess they could make a deal. They're either going to make a deal or they're going to walk away for good.
Well,
because they're not
– yeah. What I was going to say is, because most of us who watch this say to ourselves, if they could get on DirecTV, that solves all the problems in terms of the revenue generated by the network, or right now the lack of it, and the exposure of the conference as opposed to what the Big Ten network does, what the SEC network does, what the ACC is able to do.
Right. It would solve a lot of problems, maybe not all of them, but it would certainly help immensely. But I believe that AT&T is going to walk away from the Pac-12, and they're going to take DirecTV with them, and there's going to be no chance of a deal because the current partnership expires and is not going to get renewed. So if there's no more contract between AT&T and the Pac-12, then there is no chance of DirecTV ever taking the Pac-12 networks.
All right, so that issue aside, the other thing that I always am fascinated with is this continual issue about the late-night football kickoffs. And I'm just going to give you my viewpoint on this. I wasn't happy with the way ESPN treated Chris Peterson in Washington back in October. They basically treated him like a petulant 10-year-old, and they never apologized for it, both on game day and the game they did that night with Cal. On the other hand, what other options does a conference on the West Coast have? You're not going to kick off at 9 in the morning. And if you want to be on ESPN and you want to have as much of the national attention as you can get, you got to kick off at 7:30. That's all there is to it.
Well, I'm with you generally. I mean, I think that's you know, the conference wanted the money, and ESPN and Fox said, all right, if you want the money, you need to give us the flexibility to show your games at night because we have no other options at 10:30 Eastern. The issue, I think, is the number. A lot of folks understand that there have to be some night games, but there are so many night games. And when you add in the Thursday and Friday, it makes for that many more. And they're on weeknights when it's more inconvenient for people. To me, the issue with the night games is more about the egregious situations like the back-to-back road games, you know, at 7:30 or 3 out of 4 7:30 road games, you know, 3 in 4 weeks, or the Friday, a Saturday road game followed by a Friday road game, or something that Washington, like what Washington's got to do this coming season, which is back-to-back road games and Oregon. They're playing the second ones at Oregon. Oregon will have a bye, you know.
Yeah.
There are excessive situations I think conference needs to limit or eliminate. But the general at the core, the number of night games is just part of the deal. I agree with that. And you know, Washington fans are upset because they – be even with the 5 o'clock starts. They want their starts at 12:30 or 1 o'clock, but I mean, 5 o'clock is prime time. I don't know how you complain about that. So I think to a certain extent, some of the complaints are excessive or misguided, but at the same time, the conference needs to do a better job of limiting egregious scheduling demands, especially on the players.
John, real quick, where can I know you have, you can be found at San Jose Mercury News, but you're doing a podcast as well, right?
Podcast, yeah, especially August through May is podcast time. Everything can be found at Pac-12Hotline.com.
Excellent.
No dash, just Pac-12Hotline.com, including a link to my newsletter, which comes out several times. Free newsletter comes out several times a week. All the news about the conference and the greater college sports landscape.
Well, that's a good I wanted to get that out there because we recommend our fans check that out. John, appreciate the time. Safe travels wherever you're headed, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thanks very much.
John Wilner, San Jose Mercury News, about as dialed in as anybody on the Pac-12. Fascinating topics going around the conference right now. Got some soccer news to get to, and we'll talk about that right after a break on the Brad Sesmatch Show, sports360az.com, azcentralsports.com. Back on the Brad Sesmatch Show, Jeff Munn for Brad. It is Wednesday. I want to talk a little bit about tomorrow's show in a second. But the other news of the day in soccer, we mentioned earlier that Phoenix Rising FC, first game for new head coach Rick Shantz, who will finish out the season. He was an assistant to Patrice Cardion. His first match will be tonight against Las Vegas Lights FC, 7:30, over at Phoenix Rising Soccer Complex. And then they come right back Saturday night and meet the Tulsa Roughnecks, also at 7:30, out at the Phoenix Rising Soccer Complex. The other news today in soccer, FIFA has awarded the 2026 World Cup to three countries. The United States, Canada, and Mexico will jointly host the 2026 World Cup. I'll get out on this right now if somebody else hasn't, and I bet they have. Don't be too surprised if University of Phoenix Stadium is in the mix to host a World Cup game. World Cup final, I don't know, but they've had so much experience and success, and they're going to have another international soccer match at University of Phoenix Stadium coming up this summer. It would not surprise me in the least if University of Phoenix Stadium got to be part of the World Cup. And if they do, you have to go and see it. It is, there's a reason that it has the stature that it does. And of course, the 2018 World Cup competition begins tomorrow. We'll have Bill Gutekunst on tomorrow, I believe, for his regular visit. And one of the things that I'm going to bring up with him is the U.S. Open Golf Championship, which starts tomorrow at Shinnecock Hills. It is the fourth year that Fox Television has televised the U.S. Open. Every year they've done it prior to this year, they have been criticized loudly and pretty pointedly about their inability to televise major championship golf. Everything from announcers to cameras to innovations, Fox has not been able to get this right, and they have to get it right this time. They're not going to lose the contract. They pay way too much money to the USGA for the USGA to ever say, oh, we're just going to go back to NBC with Dan Hicks and Johnny Miller. But they have, and I say this, I have no axe to grind with Fox. They just do not do a good job of televising the U.S. Open, and it's just that simple. And you think about it, and we'll discuss it with Goody tomorrow. This is something I find very interesting. Fox did a terrific job revolutionizing the coverage of the NFL when they got the rights in 1994, the Fox box, all the other little innovations. But name me one other sport that Fox Sports has gotten its hands on that they've been able to do something really good with in the U.S. Now, they'll televise the World Cup. They have a lot of experience with it. They'll do a great job. But think about it. The NHL, flop. The glowing puck was panned almost immediately. To me, they don't do a very good job with college football. They don't do that great a job. They had the BCS for a couple of years. People were not that crazy about their work on the BCS. They kind of had a little bit of work in college basketball. Obviously, they can't touch getting the NCAA tournament, but the games they've had in college basketball, people aren't that thrilled with their production values on college basketball. They've had no network relationship with the NBA. I mean, there just isn't anything. I can't think of any sport that they've been able to have the impact with that they had with the NFL. And again, you look at what they've done with the U.S. Open. You think Fox and the U.S. Open, you immediately think, well, they've botched as many things as you can think of. And for an event like the U.S. Open, which is basically the Super Bowl of golf, the television coverage should not be a storyline. It shouldn't even be discussed. But it is being discussed. It is a storyline. And that tells you what an issue this has become for the Fox Network. I'm a huge fan of Joe Buck. I don't want to see him in a golf booth. I think they're getting dangerously close to overexposing a really talented announcer by sticking him on everything that you can think of outside of college athletics. He's the lead announcer on the NFL. He's the lead announcer on baseball. And he's the lead announcer on the U.S. Open. And I know Jim Nantz has the same kind of role at CBS. But for some reason, it just doesn't work with Joe Buck. Keep him on football and baseball. I don't want him on golf. But we'll discuss that with Goody tomorrow because he's an observer of those things, as am I. And who knows what we'll be talking about tomorrow in the world of sports. D-backs finish up with the Pirates. The Suns continue workouts. David Johnson still holding out. You know that even though it may look like it'll be a quiet day tomorrow, something will happen. And you know what? How you'll find out about it is by staying with sports360az.com because they update content all the time. If something breaks locally, you're going to hear about it right here. So stick with the website. We thank our partners at azcentralsports.com for partnering with us on this program. And we certainly encourage you to join us. Stick around, first of all, because coming up next is Talk to the Lopes. And you're going to really enjoy the visit with Lewis Wilson, the newest member of Dan Marley's coaching staff. And then tomorrow, join us here for more of the Brad Sesmatch Show. But stick around right now. Lewis Wilson, who is a basketball lifer, has had quite a journey as a basketball coach, and it brings him to Grand Canyon University. He is the subject of this week's Talk to the Lopes. And that's coming up next on the Brad Sesmatch Show, sports360az.com, azcentralsports.com. Time for our Talk to the Lopes segment. We do it each week here on the Brad Sesmatch Show. I'm Jeff Munn for Brad. Lewis Wilson is described in Paul Coro's article on gculopes.com as a basketball lifer. And that's one of my favorite kind of people, somebody who's been around the game most of their lives. It took him from his home in the Bronx to all kinds of places, including Alaska, Utah, and now to Grand Canyon University as the newest assistant on Dan Marley's staff. And he joins us this week on Talk to the Lopes. Coach, welcome to Arizona. How are you dealing with the heat?
Thanks, Jeff. It's like a balmy winter day in Anchorage, Alaska out there. That's how I fool myself.
You know what?
You deal with the heat by staying out of it.
That's exactly it. Well, that's how you deal with the cold in Alaska, right? You stay indoors.
That's exactly right. Extremes are extremes.
Yes. Now, you had been at Utah State as an assistant. I think the answer to this is fairly obvious, and you talked about it in your article with Paul. But what attracted you to working for Dan Marley at Grand Canyon?
Well, you know, in this business, coaches talk, people talk, and there are things that we see develop. And one of the great stories in college basketball has been the development of Grand Canyon University men's basketball over the last several years since Coach Marley has been here and the vision of Coach Mueller, President Mueller, rather. And it's just been something that we've talked about, everybody. It's like, man, you see how this program is just blowing up and the way Grand Canyon's taken off. And you watch it from afar. You admire the work and the things that are happening here. Phoenix is always a place for anybody in the country that is attractive. What a great market. What a great city. Grand Canyon's always had that, but what has developed in terms of the basketball program, the vision of the program, and the way that vision has been met with the execution of Coach Marley and his staff in the WAC, and it's something that I've admired from afar. And so, when the opportunity presented itself, I would have walked to get here.
It's interesting too. You had head coaching experience on your resume, and Dan is past the point of being brand new in terms of his head coaching experience at the D1 level. But I think it always helps any coach to have a second set of eyes and an experienced guy on his staff who's been a head coach to kind of help him. It doesn't matter whether he's been coaching for a year or 20 years. If you've got somebody with head coaching experience to your side, and you know this as a head coach yourself, that's always a plus.
Absolutely. You know, one of the, I always say the most difficult thing I've done in coaching is to go from an assistant to a head coach because of all the things you become responsible for. Our jobs are very fragmented when we're assistant coaches. You may have responsibility for the defense. You may have responsibility for recruiting. You may have responsibility for travel. And then you become a head coach and realize you have responsibility for everything that happens, every person that touches the program. And that was very, very difficult. Emotionally, it was quite difficult to go from a head coach back to an assistant after having been a head coach. And what I think the value of doing both is that you have a perspective that is totally different. When you're an assistant, you think your head coach is crazy and, you know, like, what is he thinking? Why is he doing it? And when you've had to sit in that chair and make those decisions, you gain a totally different perspective of the game and understand what they're going through in the decision-making processes and having to touch every single area of the program and having to deal with and be responsible for everyone that touches the program. So the perspective changes when you move one chair, and your appreciation for what that coach is dealing with on a day-to-day basis. So you're able to give not only the head coach a lot of help, but the other assistant coaches that you work with when you have had to sit there and make those decisions. So when people question things, you're able to answer with some, you know, authority about having been there and explain better why those decisions are being made.
Lewis Wilson, the new assistant men's basketball coach under Dan Marley at Grand Canyon. You know, I would think too, Coach, that working for Dan is also probably pretty appealing. I've known Dan for a long time, and he's not a guy that is caught up. He's not a guy driven by ego. He's not a guy that gets caught up in titles. He is the head coach, and he understands his responsibilities as a head coach, but he doesn't hold it over people's heads. And so I would think working for a guy who's not caught up in the trappings of the job, that's appealing to you as well, I would think.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Jeff, is that, you know, people have this image of Coach Marley. You know, we grew up, we watched him as a tremendous pro basketball player. And, you know, to a lot of us, he's Thunder Dan. And what I've learned very quickly, one, in watching and studying his teams on film and then being here in a very short period of time is, Thunder Dan is Coach Marley. He's a phenomenal basketball mind. He has a really good feel. His relationship development with his players is as good as I've seen in 26 years of college coaching. And he is completely unpretentious. He has not been jaded by the experience of being in college athletics as it relates to coaching with the political stuff. He's just authentic as they come. And that's very, very refreshing. He's a ball coach who deals with people in an authentic way. And because he did not grow up in his career in the college coaching culture, he doesn't come with a lot of that baggage, you know, and it's not necessarily all bad. It's just we learn a certain way in the business, you know, how to do certain things. And to him, you deal with people as they are and his relationships. And I've watched him very closely with his players. And they're very, very authentic. And young people like that. And if they like that and they like you and they respect you, you can pour yourself into them in a way that other coaches can't because they trust the investment that you're making in them, and you can see that in real relationships. So I thoroughly appreciated that in my experience thus far, and you could see that manifest itself in watching his teams play and how hard his kids play for him.
I read in Paul's story that you'll be charged with a lot of the game planning defensively for the Lopes in your role. I always think in any level of basketball, but especially in the college game, which isn't, we see a lot of three-point shooting, but it's not to the degree that it is in the pro ranks. And what I'm getting at is this. It's important to defend. The most important aspect of setting up your defense is what you do from about midcourt to the three-point line, just as much as it is denying the shot. Am I explaining that correctly?
Yeah, I think the first thing, in its most simple form, defending is stopping the basketball, period. The best defensive team stopped it from moving, stopped it from being shot in an uncontested fashion at any level. And the first order of business is stopping the basketball in transition, because that's what basketball is. That's a key element of it, whether it's fast transition or just in, you know, the definition of transition is going from offense to defense, you know, without making mistakes, making sure that you get matched up and get your defense set. If you can do that, the more often you can do that, and you know, because the game is played three-point line to three-point line at such a high level in today's game, that's what you have to do. But I think you also understand that, you know, good defense plays inside out. You have to take away the paint. And the paint in today's basketball culture is not necessarily throw it to a seven-foot guy and let him operate as much as it is spread the floor, drive and kick, and try to force you to have to defend in space. And so you have to take up space. You have to stop the basketball, take up space, and then finish the possession by rebounding the basketball. So much of analytics in the game, you watch the pro game and the college game, in some ways good and bad, are becoming indistinguishable. And analytics become a big part of it. And it says now, supposedly, you know, you shoot the three or you take a layup. And the mid-range game is not as prevalent as it was, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But defensively, defense ultimately is about getting the ball stopped, getting your defense set, taking up the offensive space, because good offense is creating space and good defense is taking away space.
Mm-hmm.
And as Grand Canyon demonstrated last year, the best defensive team versus a three-point shot, and the three-point shot is so prevalent, you're going to be an effective defensive team if you do a good job of not just contesting three-point shots, but making sure that that you do a good job of controlling them, not allowing them to take place and to happen in the first place, and then doing a good job of discouraging people and changing the shot. But you also have to do a great job of protecting that paint, whether it be versus a drive or not allowing people to operate from the post, which is old-fashioned basketball, but it still opens up three-point shots and creates problems.
Lewis Wilson, the newest member of Dan Marley's coaching staff, assistant men's basketball coach at Grand Canyon, joining us on Talk to the Lopes. There's been a lot of talk since the move to Division I about the Grand Canyon looks at Gonzaga as kind of the template for what they want to become. But at Utah State, you saw another program that is really starting to emerge on the West Coast. A lot of people are starting to talk about Nevada as a potential Final Four team next year. And I would think that, and Grand Canyon played Nevada last year in a preseason game. They'll play them during the season this year. I would think also that, given your experience with seeing what Eric Musselman is doing there, that they too provide you a little bit of a blueprint about how to get Grand Canyon to that Gonzaga-like level.
Yeah, Coach Moss has done a tremendous job there. And I've been around long enough, Jeff, to see the evolution of the Zags, which, you know, it dates back to the mid-90s. It's been a good program for a long time. It's been a national program since, you know, 99 was when they began their run. But 94, 95, I believe, they were in the NCAA tournament. That evolution has happened over a long period of time. To eventually grow into the Zags and what they are now, which is a national power. What's amazing about Nevada is how fast it's happened. You know, it has not been a 20-plus year evolution. They've been a good program. They've had pockets of high success, including a Sweet 16 run several years back. But what they have done with that basketball program as it relates to generate the talent, particularly in the transfer market, in such a short period of time, I think both blueprints you can learn a lot from. The one thing that is consistent in both is talent matters, whether you recruit it or develop it, and it's better if you recruit it and then develop it even beyond where it's at. And the talent matters, and having a plan matters, and a vision. And neither one of those things have happened by osmosis. I think a vision is being executed, and that's why, you know, so impressed with, you know, when I came here and President Mueller and spending time with him, his vision. Just everybody says we want to be the Zags. We want to be the Zags. And, you know, Nevada, what they've shown is they're not saying that. They are actually putting a plan to work. Now, it may not be a plan that's effective for everybody, but Coach Moss has done a great job of bringing in transfers and sit-out guys, leveraging the community that he has and his professional contacts, his, you know, being a former NBA coach, attracting players to come in there and be either graduate seniors that are eligible and play 1 year, or in his case, most of them are guys that come and sit a year and then are eligible to play a year or two after that. But how fast that he has done it in comparison to how long it took Gonzaga to become the Zags is the most impressive thing. And what he's done is built an NBA-style team. If you look at the Golden State Warriors, they're not, obviously, I'm not saying they're as good as the Warriors. Nobody is. But, you know, as it relates to the college game, he has interchangeable parts, five guys who can bring it in transition and play with the basketball, and then they disrupt you and your offense because they switch five ways. So they're interchangeable, they're deep, and he keeps it pretty simple, and they play, and he gets everything out of them, and they play really hard and really well together.
That's certainly the foundation of Grand Canyon basketball as well. Coach, we appreciate the time. Welcome to Arizona. Stay inside, stay cool, and boy, the season will be here before you know it. We appreciate you being with us today.
Lopes up.
Absolutely. Coach Lewis Wilson, the newest member of Dan Marley's coaching staff at Grand Canyon University, our guest on this week's edition of Talk to the Lopes. You find it every Wednesday right here on the Brad Sesmatt Show, sports360az.com. We partner with azcentralsports.com.